This is Jim Semivan, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined today on the podcast by a New York Times best-selling author and the co-author of the Secret Machines books and his latest with Tom DeLonge, Trinity, a novel. I've got AJ Hartley on the podcast. AJ, welcome.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
It's good to have you on, and it is quite strange doing one of these recordings first thing in the morning just to break the fourth podcasting wall, but I like it, I'm not going to lie. It sets my day up and it lets me get some more stuff in later on. But AJ, lots to talk about. I want to first find out, what, if any, interest did you have in the UFO topic before you started writing about it?
I mean, I was interested in it when I was a kid, you know, as an adolescent. It was one of those things I was listening to when I was about 14 or 15. I was into, you know, sort of hard and progressive rock, and listened to bands like Rush and Hawkwind and stuff like that. And occasionally they would sort of venture into these kind of territories. And I remember reading Eric Von Daniken and people like that. And I used to watch things, you know, you remember Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World and those kind of shows. So, you know, I was passively interested in this subject for a while. And, you know, once in a while, we would see things that we couldn't completely, you know, put a name to. And that was all very exciting. But I didn't do a lot of research around it. And, you know, as I'm sure you have heard by now, one of the episodes in The Secret Machines, actually, I think it's the first of those little interlude moments, which is set in Japan. And is just an account of somebody going for a bike ride and seeing a sort of cigar shaped object silhouetted against the moon. And that was mine. That was my own experience from when I lived in Yamanashi in whatever that was, 87, something like that. So, you know, it was a subject that I was interested in and curious about, but it wasn't something that I had researched heavily until Tom approached me and we started talking seriously about the prospect of doing those books.
Well, how did that come about then, that relationship and meeting with Tom DeLonge the first time?
I mean, I'm not absolutely sure. I think that he had already made a connection with Suzanne Young, who did the poet Anderson, the Of Nightmares book. And she, I think, was repped by my agent, by Stacey Glick at Distel and Godrich, as it was, and in New York. And she called me one day and said, this guy from Blink 182 is looking for somebody to work with him on this, these sort of UFO related thrillers. And do you want to be considered? And it was an odd time for me in terms of where I was in my publishing career, because I had a couple of different books that had been on submission for months and months and months, and I kind of thought they were dead. And so I was like, well, you know, I mean, that sounds kind of cool, you know, and working with a rock star and subject matter sounds interesting. So I was like, yeah, sure. Yeah, go ahead and toss my hat in the ring and see what he thinks. And so she then sent him some of my earlier books. And I guess Tom connected with them because they weren't sci-fi. They were historical fiction. And he wanted to sort of frame the Secret Machines project less as a sci-fi project and more as a kind of as a historical fiction project. So at some point he decided that I was the one he wanted to talk to. So we started having phone calls with and without the agent, trying to figure out what this project would look like and how it would shape up. And then when it started to be something that it looked like, you know, I was going to pursue seriously, he flew me out to California and we spent a few days in Encinitas, sort of brainstorming and figuring out what this thing was going to be. Because as I've said a number of times, he had ideas, and there had even been, I think, a screenplay at one point, a sort of fairly simple version of the story. But he said, you know, he wanted this to be this huge, expansive thing set all over the world and in every sort of period of human history possible. And that was like, and that was fairly terrifying because I was like, I don't know how to tell that story, you know?
Yeah.
Usually you ground the story in a single location. You build it around a specific core set of characters who are constantly interacting with each other, and you build an arc that way. So the idea of something that was going to span all time and space and what have you, I was like, I'm not sure what that is. So we thrashed around for a while, and there were particular sort of historical points that he wanted to cover, moments and ideas that he wanted introduced into the books. And my job was initially was to try to figure out the architecture of the story, to see how we would do that in a way that would feel sort of organic rather than, you know, a main plot and then with loads of little info dumps, you know what I mean? Where, yeah, for whatever reason, there's a tangent where you suddenly get, oh, and here's another UFO incident that is, it's like, well, that's going to feel weird. So we had to sort of build this narrative that would allow us that kind of space to range around in time and geography and cover all this separate stuff. And I think, you know, for me, hitting on the sort of multiple character perspective, which would give each of them a separate story in a different part of history and a different part of the world, but would gradually sort of move all those narratives together and interweave them steadily, was kind of the key to figuring out how it was going to work. And then I had the idea of interspersing it with these related but separate interludes that would allow us to get more stuff in there without completely derailing the main narrative. And the last big idea, I think, was to make the chapters increasingly short so that the pacing of the story creates, as the different storylines start to come to a point, there's an urgency to it as these sort of chapters go from like whatever it is, 15 pages down to 5 pages to 2 pages to like a single paragraph or whatever, you know, as everything comes to a head. And I thought that would be a sort of cool cinematic way of bringing all the things into play, you know.
That certainly comes across. And speaking about those like Chasing Shadows and Fire Within, the first two Secret Machines books,
yeah.
I don't know how you feel about this as an author, but you might recoil in horror. I use the audiobook versions, and I've said this many times on the podcast. I don't get a lot of time to read, but I do get quite a bit of time driving. So for me, that's ideal. That pacing you talk about comes across in the audiobook, because I can't remember the gentleman's name who reads them. But he's fantastic, and he's got this gravitas to his voice, and you notice that more and more the chapters are coming thick and fast, and it gives you that real pacing and tension, and you can see that translating to a TV show or a movie, which I believe the plans are, I think, still.
I believe so too. I mean, you know, the in publishing, everybody says no until somebody says yes, and in film and TV, everybody says yes until somebody says no.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Secret Machines, incidentally, I love audiobooks, so I have no issue with what you're saying at all. But, you know, yeah, the Secret Machines were optioned by Legendary Entertainment, but it's been like 4 years, and I don't really know, because, you know, the way the contracts are structured, I'm sort of minimally involved.
Yeah.
I've spoken to a couple of people in the development process, but not for a while. And I know there's a pilot script, which I've seen, and I believe they're trying to attach a director at the moment, but it's just incredibly slow because, unlike a book, movies and TV shows take huge teams of people and colossal amounts of money.
Yeah.
And they're not going to green light it until they're absolutely sure that all the pieces are in place and it's going to work, you know? So I have my fingers crossed that we're going to see it. But that's as much information as I have, which, and that of course impacts the third Secret Machines book as well. We've been sitting on our hands for a while, but I don't know whether it was a contractual thing or whether it was just either their present preference or Tom's preference, but the decision was made early on that we were not going to do the third Secret Machines book until the TV show stuff was in place. I don't know whether that means until it's actually airing or what, but there was a concern that we didn't want to get into the situation that they had with something like Game of Thrones, where there was a discrepancy between what was happening at the big sort of climactic final scenes in the TV show and the books. And they were like, not, you know, because people were unhappy about that sort of divergence between the two. So, you know, I think, yeah, we've been sort of in suspended animation, and you know, I have wanted to write the final books for a while, not least because I'm getting old and it gets harder and harder to remember what I did in the last one. but yeah, we're sort of in suspended animation at the moment on that.
That's good to know as an update. And I want to know, you having, let's say, a baseline interest in the UFO topic, you've had a sighting when you were younger, you know the topic, you know, you're not a deep researcher that's going into it daily, but you've got enough to go, yeah, UFOs, that's interesting. You've got Tom DeLonge, who you'll know from his time with Blink-182. And whenever people see Tom DeLonge, if you haven't, folks listening or watching, he can info dump like no one. You know, he's just got so many thoughts and ideas in his head, hasn't he, AJ? And it just all comes out his mouth in a stream of stuff. Is that what it's like for you when you sit down with him and you're trying to, I'm guessing you're looking to plan, to structure, to have a narrative set, and he just wants to put in all this information? What's that like for you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the great things about Tom is that he is a genuine collaborator. You know, I've said this a couple of times. He's not one of these people who sort of feeds you stuff and then expects the version of the story as he imagined it to appear on the page. You know, he treats me as a real collaborative presence. And so most of the time he'll sort of say, here are all these things that I want to get into the story, and here are all these ideas that I want to sort of emerge. But how you do that is up to you and what you choose. And if, for example, if he sends me and he'll send me, like, as you say, he gets excited about all these different things. And sometimes, because I'm an academic, I'm a novelist, but I'm also an academic. I've been a Shakespeare professor for 30 years. And being a professor is all about evidence. You know, and so sometimes he'll send me things and I'll start poking into them and I'll be like, I'm not buying this. I don't think it holds together. I don't think it's a good thing to incorporate into the story. And he'll be like, fine, okay. You know, so part of what, yes, the way that we work often is that he'll throw a ton of stuff and then I have to sort of filter and organize. And because I'm a novelist, because I'm a storyteller, for me, character is all, you know, and I know that that's not what the majority of your listeners will be interested in. But for me as a storyteller, that's how these things have to work. That whatever is going on, whatever interesting or revelatory bits of information we're going to sort of embed within there or explore within there, they have to fit organically within the story. And if I can't do that, then we either have to completely reshape the story or we don't use them.
No, and I agree. If people haven't read or listened to Secret Machines 1 and 2 or Trinity, as we're going to talk about in a moment, you do have to care about the characters. Otherwise, it can be a slog to get through, or it can be difficult. If we look at Three Body Problem, I don't know if you had a chance to read or see that when it was on Netflix, but I tried to read the Chinese translation, and it was difficult just because of the translation and the way that was coming across. Yeah. And then when you watch the TV series, I watched the Chinese version, which is 40 episodes, something like that, and I cared about the characters. I watched the US-UK version, and I didn't care about the characters. I didn't like what they'd done to it. So they're essentially the same TV show from the same source material, with a subject I love and have a big interest in, you know, how are these aliens going to appear? What are they? What's the whole concept going to be? Are they going to arrive? One of them I really cared about and got bought into, and the other I didn't, because it was like Friends, the TV show with aliens, and I didn't like that and how it was come across. So I get why that's really important. Has Tom ever said anything to you, and you touch on the way you're trying to write and put these ideas onto paper in a way that it makes sense, that in terms of the UFO topic, you've just thought, where did you get that from? And Tom comes from a place of knowledge and opinion, and things have been put together from his own ideas, but things he's been told from other people. Is there anything like that you can discuss where you've been like, you never heard that before, something sounded completely ridiculous, but Tom gave you a real basis as to why it was important and why it should be in the book?
I mean, yeah, he's constantly throwing things at me that I didn't know about. But as you say, I was not like a hardcore UFO researcher. So there were all sorts of things. And one of the things that Tom would do was recommend books to me, you know, and he would have sort of pre-screened the things that he thought were the most solid accounts of particular events and things like that, Dolan books and what have you, that I would then mine to see if I could then take a sort of imaginative spin on, you know, how could I maybe tell the story from the perspective of a marginal character, you know, so that I'm not trying to significantly increase or speculate beyond the information that I have, but I can find a way to present it in a way that I think is interesting or compelling. And yeah, and from time to time, you know, he's said things, and it is tricky. He's said things to me where he's then retracted. You know, we think this is going on. And then like a month or so later, he'll say, yeah, it's maybe not. And I think this is also one of the issues with the timing of the third book. I think, you know, within the last few years, the topic has changed, right? Mm. And the visibility of the topic has changed, and the congressional hearings and all the rest of it. And so we're kind of at a point where we're waiting for the other shoe to drop in terms of other kinds of information or revelation. And the problem with the third book of a trilogy is you can't take it back.
Yeah.
You know, once you commit to it and say, here's what we think, then that's it. You know, now there's the novelist part of me doesn't care, right? The novelist part of me says, if the story's coherent, then that's fine. And if yep. it then turns out that that's not true, then it's okay, because this is a work of fiction. Now, from Tom's perspective, because his commitment is to sort of engage with things that are real, that would be an issue. That would be a problem. You know, but in the first two books, you can float things and then you can walk them back. Oh, well, we saw this in book one. And then in book two, it's like, well, actually, it turns out that what we thought we saw, we didn't. We mm-hmm. saw something else. But you can't do that at the end of the series. So I think one of Tom's other concerns as far as the release of the third book is wanting to be in a place where he feels confident in saying, here's what we think. And not have to then sort of walk it back or rethink it. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because, as I said, and that's the tightrope that you're on all the time, right? Because on the one hand, you are trying to engage with things that are real and raise real ideas about things that are real. But on the other hand, it's a work of fiction. And I get a little irritated with the sort of UFO Twitter crowd when people are like, well, yeah, the books are too long, so just provide me with the main points. It's like, read, learn to read and learn to distinguish truth from fiction and learn to understand how these things are supposed to work, you know, and it's not a bullet point list of here are the revelations. That's just not how these things work. It's not how books work, you know?
You don't get the same payoff from that either, do you? If someone said to you, here's Infinity War and Endgame, we'll give you like the 5-minute trailer of the full thing, you're not getting the same emotional experience. You might get the big, oh, that's cool, but you're not getting taken on a journey and along for it. And I don't get to read or listen to the audiobooks as much as I would like, but I can tell you the last couple that I did, Secret Machines, thoroughly enjoyed. And, you know, I looked forward to long drives because I had those and those characters to go along with. And plus, there's so much of the UFO story that goes in there. And I think when you're involved and invested in this topic and you know Tom DeLonge and his interest and the people he hangs about with and has hung about with, you're always listening for those little nuggets of, is that opinion or is that something that really happened? So it kind of keeps you intrigued along the way. I will ask, just before Trinity, is there anything that you have taken out of those books or Trinity that you've had to leave on the cutting room floor that you wish had been in there or you couldn't have in for any reason?
I mean, yeah, there are bits all over the place, you know, and as I say, you know, we're going to, as far as the beginning of the Secret Machines project is concerned, we're going back almost 10 years at this point. So, you know, there were all kinds of things that I was working on or researching or processing from Tom that we floated and then for whatever reason decided not to keep. Some of them we may come back to, some of them we won't. And then there's all that sort of little bits of irritating editorial stuff where some, you know, I had a section once in one of these books when we were talking about the firepower on one of these ships. And we were talking about why you had to use lasers because they were so fast that you couldn't use conventional firearms because they were faster than the bullets that they fired. And this editor, I shouldn't be saying this. Anyway, it led to the removal of a chunk because the person who had provided the editorial feedback didn't know as much about physics as he thought he did.
Okay.
And so some stuff got taken out, which I was irritated by, because it was stuff that I had researched really thoroughly, and I knew exactly what I was talking about. But it's sort of counterintuitive, and the person who was sort of anyway, yeah. So the stuff like sorry,
I get the gist of that. No, I get that
vague booking, but you know. Yeah.
On that, so you'll understand and you'll know far better than I will anyway. For example, Luis Elizondo has a book coming out called Imminent that goes through a DOPSA review, as does books from George Knapp, Colm Kelleher, James Lakatsky. They go through DOPSA reviews where they get checked by the government. Has it got anything that could be damaging to national security, that kind of stuff? I doubt the books that you and Tom are writing go through that process, but I wonder, in the same breath, has there ever been any intervention by folks who aren't looking for editorial issues like that and have maybe seen something within them? Or has Tom came along to you after 5 months and been like, you know, when we said this, we need to take that out? Not because he's changed his mind, but because someone said to him, no, you can't include that.
Yeah. Tom hasn't. Lou has. I was talking to Lou last year and he was telling me some stuff and he's like, yeah, you can't use this. This is, you know, off the record. But as far as the actual sort of, you know, DOD or whoever screening, no. And again, that's because they're novels, right? Mm. Now, I'm sure you've heard Jim Samivan, I think it was Jim, said that when, you know, the first Secret Machines book came out, all the phones at the CIA started ringing. Because some people supposedly perceived that, you know, things being said there that were maybe closer to the truth than people wanted them to be. But I don't think that those books were on anybody's radar until they came out.
Mm.
I may be wrong. And it could be that, you know, we're now being more closely monitored in some ways. But But certainly initially, no, we didn't, nothing was vetted because, you know, as with all works of fiction, it says in the book, this is a work of fiction.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it would take something fairly special for the intelligence services or the DOD to want to start, you know, what do you call it?
DOPSR or like doing that
kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, the process of it's gone out of my, word has gone out of my head. Just the sort of censorship stuff. Yeah.
Sure. Redacting.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that. No, that's interesting. And let's talk about Trinity then. So I don't have my copy behind me because I bought one of the signed copies numbered. Well, actually, they're not numbered. They come out saying blank of 100.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why.
So I remember when it first came out, I got mine a bit later because I'm in the UK. So people getting them in the US got them first because that's how the world works. And I think a few folks thought they got special copies because there was no number inside them. But do you know what? There's a niceness to that. You could have copied one. You could have copied 100. Who knows?
Right.
It's
right.
Whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
But Trinity as an event, a lot of folks will think of the Paola Harris, Jacques Vallée book and an incident that has largely for many been debunked now as a hoax. I'll let folks make up their own mind on that. There's a lot of folks done some good work and research on it. This is not what that book's about, is it? If you want to summarize Trinity, a novel.
Yeah, it's not about that. I mean, I think Tom wanted to sort of to allude indirectly to that as a similar kind of case. And I read the Jacques Vallée book and emerged unconvinced, personally. There was some cool stuff in it along the way, and there were some potentially teasing things that I thought were more interesting. But the main core of the book, I didn't buy. And I thought the evidence just didn't hold up for me.
Yeah.
So this is not and that we're talking about what, 1947?
Yeah, before Roswell. It was before,
yeah, in,
before
Roswell. 47? Anyway, it was in the 40s and it was in New Mexico. And Trinity is set in an imaginary town called Trinity, which is in Nevada, on the edge of the atomic testing ground. And so, you know, it follows a similar kind of story to the Trinity explosion in the Vallée book. But obviously it's different. And, you know, the story centers on some high school kids, particularly on Van Lopez and his family, and who are living in this area close to the American airbase. And this was in the time of that sort of nuclear tourism when people would travel to come and see the mushroom cloud, if you can believe that. And so, you know, they're used to this in this community, and, you know, they go to check it out. And there are all kinds of like personal rivalries and things going on within the town because it's a high school story in many ways, you know. And then the atomic test takes place and it brings something down, and the consequences of that and the intrigue surrounding who is then trying to contain it and why, that's the heart of the story. It's a very simple story. It's, and in this sense, totally unlike Secret Machines, which has all these moving parts and lots of different. And this is basically, you know, spans, the core of it is a few days, you know, in a single moment in time. So part of what I was charged to do, because Tom had, you know, the core story already worked out. There was a screenplay being sketched out at the time, which I was not involved in. And they showed it to me and he said, okay, you know, I want to develop the car culture of the early 60s. I want to get that sense of who these people are in this particular moment in time, and the early space race and the anxiety about the Soviets and all that sort of stuff. I want to build this world so that it feels real, and to anchor this particular event. And then, you know, and there were other changes that I made to the original story. I shifted up the cast, changed who was in it and what was going on. So that's it. So, I mean, it is the sort of story. It's got a sort of, it's like a roller coaster, you know, the first, not in that up and down, up and down, up and down version of the roller coaster metaphor. I mean that it builds to a particular moment, and then the momentum that you've achieved when you, by getting to the top, is what propels you all the way through to the end of the book. Because it's after that point, it's just consequence. One thing leads to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. So it feels like an adventure. And it's very cinematic, I think. And I hope that at some point the movie will get made. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. And based on the Starfish Prime incident in the 60s, where there was an atomic test done in space, because the US, the Russians have some wonderful ideas like that. Where can we blow up nuclear weapons next? And they had these high altitude tests.
Yeah.
And allegedly something was knocked out the sky. Now, the tests in Starfish Prime happened over the ocean. Yeah. You've obviously moved this story to over the land, over the area, which makes a bit more sense in that respect. Otherwise, the cast would have all had to have been at sea, wouldn't they? Which is much harder to write, and they're all on boats. That sort of
story. We touched on Starfish Prime in the second Secret Machines book, right?
Yes.
As well. Yeah. So So this is, we wanted to make it, you know, have a different feel to it.
It's a fascinating case and an interesting case, and it's built into a wonderful narrative in the world you've built around these characters. You get to know the people, the human beings. It's got that Tom DeLonge feel to it. If anyone's seen, and you'll have seen AJ, Monsters in California, you get that immaturity in some of the characters coming across, and that's very Tom DeLonge. Regarding the overall idea of this sort of book, I wonder, you know, they're based in truth. How much truth is only Tom will know, and I'm sure you know part of that in Tom's advisors. But do you feel that this is information being put out now through these books, through Secret Machines? Do you feel it's more relevant now, or that it will be down the line?
I think that part of what these books are supposed to do, and what I think they have been doing, is shifting the conversation and making it more central, more so, taking it from the margins and moving it into sort of mainstream culture. I mean, the idea, you know, 20 years ago, the idea that we would be having those congressional hearings and things would have been almost inconceivable, you know? And so I think that, what these books are supposed to do is sort of raise the level of that background chatter, you know, and to sort of present these things in the way that something like, I don't know, the X-Files or something did back in the 90s, I guess, in terms of moving a topic which has been sort of on the fringe of serious conversation and nudging it a little bit more into the center, while giving people, you know, a fun, entertaining, hopefully, read or movie or whatever it is, TV show. But yeah, I think it's, for me, and Tom may feel differently, for me, it's not about giving answers. It's about a general sort of zeitgeist. It's about moving the needle very slightly and raising awareness and conversation and trying to get people to sort of, to take things seriously, which they might not have done. And this is why I say, in some ways, you know, that the hardcore UFO populace, yourself included, and I don't mean this in a bad way, is not the target audience for me, you know, because you already know, you're already engaged, you already take this stuff seriously. So for me as a writer, you know, I want to be able to sort of sneak this stuff in under the radar, as it were, of people who were just sort of picking up a book and thought, oh, let's see what this is, you know, and come out of it thinking, huh, maybe there's something to this. So that, you know, but I know that, I mean, Tom is much more direct in his agenda. But as the sort of storyteller, I'm more like, I'm trying to sort of push a conversation rather than an answer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that collaboration pays off. Well, I can only speak for myself, but I really enjoy that narrative and that world, and it does take a lot to hook me into something. I can watch 5 minutes of a TV show or the opening of a book or whatever it may be, and within a few minutes I'll make up my mind that I'm not going to stick with it anymore. Game of Thrones, don't like it. Watched the first episode, not a fan. Lord of the Rings, seen all the movies, don't like them. You know, I read The Hobbit when I was in school. I was quite young when I read The Hobbit. But I appreciate why people do. But just personally, it takes a lot to hook me in, and these done that. So I'm not just saying that, otherwise I wouldn't have had you on. So we'll get to some listener questions, AJ, in the last couple of minutes. So thank you to everyone who sent stuff in. Hopefully we can get to a few of you. Algo said, I assume sometimes UAP secrets are divulged in the disguise of fiction. Can AJ name 3 books or movies where you think this may be the case? What about them might be a true aspect?
That's a lot. Close Encounters. Carl Sagan's Contact. Arrival. And I mean, in each case of those, again, for me as a writer, they're all compelling stories, you know,
yeah.
that the heart of them is the human element, which I really relate to. But I also think that they present 3 different versions of sort of first contact that I find, you know, compellingly plausible. And obviously your audience will know what the differences are between them. But it's an interesting question. I'll have to think some more about it.
No, I can appreciate that, and I like that in an alien UFO movie. If it's just a typical alien invasion style thing, other than Independence Day, which I think nailed it, the first one, obviously. I like District 9. I think that's really interesting that aliens come, they're refugees, essentially. They've got this wonderful technology, but they end up being integrated in the slums of Johannesburg. I think that's a really interesting concept. But yeah, I'm with you on that. Scott asks a question. AJ heavily teased the Blink-182 reunion before it happened. How long in advance did he know about that?
I want to say about 9 months. I had Tom on my little YouTube channel, and we were talking about just sort of general writery stuff. And as soon as I turned the camera off, he's like, okay, so there's some stuff you need to know. And he's like, yeah, we're back in the studio. We've got this world tour planned. And I kept waiting for the announcement because I was like, if he's telling me, then it's got to be imminent. Mm. And it didn't get announced until the following, that was in March, I think. And it didn't get announced until, I want to say like October.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was a long time to sit on that without telling anybody, because I knew it was going to be a big deal. I knew it would raise the profile, not just of the band again, but also of the stuff that we were doing, you know, outside Blink. So yeah, it was cool.
Nice. Awesome. I like this question from Tree of Life. If AJ had to adapt a famous UFO or abduction case for fiction, which would it be?
I think, you know, something like the Belgian triangle wave stuff would be really interesting because, you know, we've seen so much of the recent conversation has been driven by Navy pilots and people who have a kind of seriousness, an aura of seriousness around them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes what people want from us is more and more of the sort of hard detail and I think the idea of, you know, serious civil and military authorities responding to sightings and what have you, I think has a kind of automatic weight that gives it the allure of science and seriousness and respectability, which frequently these things don't. You know, if it's some hillbilly in the woods being abducted, then it's his story against the world. But when things play out in front of large numbers of serious people, it's a different thing.
Yeah, no, I like that. Good answer. Two questions left from Aaron. I'm curious about AJ's experience balancing background research to lend authenticity to the events of novels and crafting an original, distinct narrative. What is the most challenging aspect to writing books that harmonize both of these intentions?
I think one of the hard things is doing all the research and then not using it, you know, because you don't want to do, I don't want to do that sort of Tom Clancy thing where somebody, you know, gets his M16 out and then you get three pages on how you use an M16, which is like, okay, but now I'm out of the story. Now I'm being given a sort of technical work manual, you know? And so, you know, sometimes to do a lot of work, I mean, I spent a lot of time talking to Harrier pilots about, to try and sort of get the feel of how that particular aircraft functions in ways that's different from other aircraft. But there's only so much in terms of technical specs that you can finish up using in a novel without it derailing the narrative, without it slowing, yeah. Especially if it's in like an action sequence. It's like, you know, you're in aerial combat. The last thing a character is going to be aware of in that moment is all the sort of technical permutations of what the aircraft is doing. So, you know, that's the difficulty. You want to create enough, especially if you're trying to evoke a character. Characters know places and the equipment that they work with, and they know it so well that they don't think about it. Mm-hmm. So you need just enough research to make the character and the environment feel real, but not so much that it feels like you're being lectured, because the character wouldn't think in those terms. You know what I mean? Yep. If you have something that you do on a regular basis, you don't think about it as you do it, you know? So, yeah. So I think it's finding that balance between what anchors the story and what upstages the story. You know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Absolutely. And last question from Christian. I'll read Christian's question first, but then I'm going to have to rephrase it, and you'll see why. Christian says, I know a lot of the Secret Machines books are based on true events. Who are the real Jennifer and who is Tamika? First and last names, addresses and social security numbers, please. But I think what Christian's getting at there is there's an assumption that these are real folks, real figures that Tom knows and has placed into these. How much of that is correct? And I wonder, is any of these, you know, synonyms ever been in touch?
Yeah, no, these are characters I made up because it's a novel, right? I mean,
no one at all.
There may be, you know, there may be real people ghosting in some of the secondary characters particularly, but as far as characters are concerned, the main characters, no, I made them up.
Yeah, which I'm sure is a lot safer for you as well to be working with.
Yeah.
Listen, let's finish off there because I know you had a limited time, AJ, today. It's been really good talking to you, and I appreciate you've kind of gone all over with those as well. Genuinely, folks, I'm a big fan of those Secret Machines books, so do check them out. And you've got a little bit of time, it sounds like, before a third book appears, so, you know, you can do that at your own pace. You can get a copy of the books on all the usual places. I've got Audible, which I've found the listening to them been fantastic. Trinity as well, I've picked up my copy. I know AJ was doing a book signing just the last couple of days down south. If I hadn't been so busy, I was tempted to drive down, but I picked up my signed copy anyway, AJ. But I wonder, what are you kind of working on just now? And is there any projected timeline for any future UFO books coming?
There is another book that I have just been doing with Tom, which is a separate thing. I don't know what the timeline is on release of that. My guess would be probably close to about a year from now. But again, that's a separate thing. There are various, you know, TV and film projects in the works, but the timeline of those I don't really know. My own next independent project is I wrote a book a year or so ago called Hideki Smith, Demon Queller, which is sort of a fantasy thing involving a lot of Japanese mythology and folklore. And I'm going to be working on the second one in that series.
Awesome. Well, I'll put the link to your website so people can check out any of that stuff, your own background, the history of the many books you've worked on. And again, AJ, thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
Cheers, Andy. Thanks very much.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium, YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right inside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me